Talk.
Good morning, it's 8:03 in Hong Kong. Welcome to this special budget edition of Money Talk with me, Peter Lewis. Hong Kong's financial secretary has delivered his ninth and possibly final Hong Kong budget. He spoke of a new economic order, which will provide opportunities for emerging industries. The results were short-term tax and relief measures of 39 billion Hong Kong dollars and incentives and handouts for startups, particularly in the technology sector. But did it deliver for businesses overall and for Hong Kongers? Has the financial secretary favoured business too much over ordinary people? On this morning's Money Talk, we shall analyse the impact of the budget on Hong Kong and the money in your pockets with a special panel of guests. And we'd also like to hear from you. Tell us your thoughts about the budget, how it affects you, and feel free to ask questions of our expert guests. Text us on 63 93 59 25. You can email us moneytalk@rthk.hk. You'll find us on Facebook, Money Talk on RTHK Radio 3, and also on Twitter at Money Talk R3.
Money Talk on RTHK Radio 3.
Before we go to our panel, a very quick look at how markets have moved overnight. A big rebound in crude oil has helped US stocks recover from sharp losses. The S&P 500 index closed up 0.4% after being down as much as 1.6% earlier in the day. It finished at 1,929. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 53 points to 16,484. And the Nasdaq closed 0.9% higher at 4,542. Energy, materials and technology stocks led the advance in the US. In Europe, the FTSE Eurofirst 300 index fell 2.3%. BHP Billiton had its biggest one-day fall since the financial crisis, losing 8.4%. Brent crude oil rose 3.6% to $34.47 a barrel, having fallen to $32.37 a barrel earlier in the day. In the currency markets, the British pound fell below $1.39 on Brexit fears. It's since rebounded a little to trade at $1.3932. And against the Hong Kong dollar, sterling buys 10.8 Hong Kong dollars. And HSBC is warning that it may still have another 20% to fall if the UK votes to leave the European Union in June. Here in Asia, the ASX 200 has opened down 0.3%. The Nikkei 225 has opened up 0.4%. And futures are indicating mainland Chinese stocks will open up around about 0.4%. And Hong Kong stocks will open up around about 0.7%. So let's get straight to our budget panel. Joining me in the studio this morning are Charles Kinsley, tax principal at KPMG, David Webb, independent analyst and author of website.com. We have Michael Every, who's head of financial markets research for Asia Pacific at Rabobank, and Enzio von Pfahl, investment strategist at Private Capital. Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
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 So listening through the budget yesterday live, it sounded to me rather safe and cautious. There were no controversial measures, no radical new policy initiatives or overhauls. However, afterwards, some people, such as the Business and Professionals Alliance, said it was the best budget out of his nine so far. So maybe, Charles, I could start with you. What was your overall impression of what you heard yesterday?
Yeah, Peter, to be honest, no real surprise. Largely what we expected. Once again, I think still short in long-term vision.
David, do you think it adequately addressed the issues facing Hong Kong?
No, it's a ninth year of wasted opportunities. It's amazing you can go 9 years without making any meaningful structural reform to Hong Kong, to Hong Kong's fiscal system. They continue to breach the basic law by running the budget faster than the growth in GDP. Although they focus on the amount they're spending, which is now 21% of GDP, up from 18% at the handover, they're actually taking in about 23% of GDP in revenues and salting it away and now doing it deliberately. There's an open policy not to balance the budget but to run surpluses and put them in the so-called future fund, which is against the basic law, which requires that the government should balance the budget and keep growth of expenditure and budget in line with GDP. and the government is basically being run for profit rather than for people. This is the problem. And at the more detailed level, there was no restructuring of the tax system. They continue to get more and more reliant on stamp duties, which used to be of the order of 5 to 10 billion. Now it's about 50 billion a year. That's a frictional tax on the movement of assets, not on GDP or profits. People can make losses when they sell property and still have to pay enormous amounts of stamp duty. Foreigners who are looking to either move here with their skill set will have to wait 7 years before they can become a permanent resident or pay 23.5% stamp duty. And businesses looking to buy premises will have to pay 2 years' rent in stamp duty. That's 8.5% double stamp duty because they are companies and not permanent residents without a home. So they've made the tax system worse over the 9 years of John Jang's financial secretary status, and not better. And meanwhile, they tinker with things like rebates. 75% of tax up to a certain amount, which just, you know, distorts the tax system. What they really need to do is actually cut rates. If you want to stimulate the economy, the most obvious thing you can do is reduce tax rates when you're taking in too much revenue. And he refuses to look at that and instead fills the budget with gimmicks like Iron Man coming to Disneyland. I mean, hooray. So. And more food trucks. He's increased the allowance to 16 food trucks so we can have more of a sort of bake-off competition. And I'm looking forward to having kebabs at Disneyland.
So quite a lot of things there. Michael, I mean, you know, one of the things that David was talking about is, you know, he's building up these reserves, given that he's forecasting that, you know, soon we're going to have deficits rather than the surpluses he's been blessed with over the last 9 years. Is it right to save up for a rainy day and start squirreling away some of these surpluses, or should he be returning them to taxpayers?
Well, besides the legal issue that was just raised, or the constitutional issue, I think it is prudent, you know, on one hand, to think about the future, but on the other hand, you could say, when you look at the rising socio-economic tensions within Hong Kong, which are very much evident, why isn't he starting to think about today being a partially rainy day now already? I mean, there are so many challenges facing Hong Kong. And as David said, basically this budget seems to have done none of them. And if I had to think of a visual metaphor for the thing, it's like a Hong Kong taxi. You know, it's still got the job done, but it's looking a bit tatty, nothing new there. And, you know, when you come back after a few years away, you think, oh, they haven't changed at all. And it's exactly the same for the budget.
And Zio, do you feel that this sort of balanced out the requirements of businesses, the middle class, the poor? What's your overall
thoughts? Well, I'll step back a little bit. I wanted to, first of all, find out what are synonyms for sweeteners. And I find out that we have things that we put into our coffee, sweetened low, equal spoonful, sugar alcohol, acid saccharin, and sweet pearl. They sound like rock bands to me, but that's kind of my view of the budget, that it's really, he's treating structural issues with cyclical medicines. We know that there's going to be a budget deficit next year of some $29 billion, and he's not, as David was pointing out, he's not attacking any structural problems whatsoever. In fact, according to the South China this morning, he was just giving us a campaign speech to become the next CE.
Now, on those sweeteners, I remember in 2014 he declared his intention to gradually reduce sweeteners, saying tax rebates and one-off relief measures would soon become history, in his words. Instead, we seem to be seeing more of them. He forecasts his surplus for this year is going to be $30 billion, although I think there's a little bit of an accounting trick there, isn't there, because he's put away $45 billion into the housing fund. But nevertheless, he's got a surplus again. But Charles, do you think this is the right way to address long-term structural issues, or should we be getting rid of these sweeteners and looking at some other way of trying to address the problems?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there needs to be more of a long-term vision and an investment for the future. Doing everything on a piecemeal one-off basis, I just don't think it's the right solution. There's certainly, you know, he's made comments of the impact of the sweeteners being 1% on GDP. Exactly how he gets to those figures, I'm not too sure, but, you know, I would think...
I think he just divides sweeteners by GDP, which doesn't allow for the fact that you're taking the money out of the economy through excessive taxation. So
essentially it's almost a zero-sum game, yeah. So, yeah, my view, there must be a better use of that money for the long term.
Yeah, and David, clearly you don't like these sweeteners, but what's going to make it change then? You know, what can we do to get this approach
to change? Well, it would help if we had a financially literate financial secretary. I mean, somebody who understood economics and finance and the basic principles on which Hong Kong's success was built in the past. To take a root and branch review of the tax system and the land lease system as well, because part of the oddity of our budget is caused by the massive amounts of land premiums that we take in up front rather than taking in higher ground rents over the useful terms of the leases.
And that's a tax on people, isn't it, really?
Yes, it certainly is. It flows through into the property sector. It's basically a sort of feudal land system where the landlords, the big developers, collect royalties for the crown and pay them to the king. and that is basically the land premium system. If we had 30% ground rents of rateable value rather than 3% for all new leases, then we'd have a more stable recurrent revenue stream in the future from that, lower premiums up front, easier access to the development sector then, lower capital cost for people who own property because they'd have to pay higher rents to the government instead. And all of that would substantially alter the financial picture. But instead, you have a government that's basically taken about $1 trillion Hong Kong dollars out of taxpayers' pockets over the the 18 years since the handover, and salted it away in reserves. And now, because they realize that you can't just buy bonds with that, you don't get very great returns, they are taking more risk by siloing part of it into a so-called future fund, but not for any specific purpose. There's been no identified purpose for this future fund. And in fact, the closer we get to 2047, the purpose will likely be absorption into the mainland financial system.
Well, also of covering other deficits, the bridge, the railway, the cultural center, the cultural hub.
Iron Man's not free either.
Yes.
Well, yes, the government owns the majority of Disneyland. It does, having these reserves tempts you to squander money on things like the Express Rail Link, which is, you know, now an $85 billion project, and the bridge to Macau, which will simply bring in more air pollution on the road system and more demand for space at the airport. So then you have to build a third runway. It's not that there's much indigenous growth in air traffic from people going on holiday or business trips from Hong Kong. It's all about generating more transit traffic through the bridge and other things and increasing the air pollution problem.
Now, Michael, let me ask you about the economy. He was very downbeat about the prospects for the economy this year. He was forecasting growth of just 1 to 2% compared to 2.4% last year. He also said in his press conference that if it wasn't for his raft of measures that will boost the economy by 1.1% this year, we would have negative growth. And he said the local economy is laden with risks in the year ahead, and the outlook is far from promising. I mean, as well as, I suppose, questioning how does he calculate the fact that all these measures boost the economy by 1.1%? So it's not entirely clear to me. But you know, what's your sense of, you know, what the headwinds are facing this economy? Is he being too downbeat, do you think, or has he got this right?
I personally think he's got it right. That's one of the only areas when I was reading it that I thought, yep, bang on, you actually understand what's going on here. But unfortunately, that really underlines the fact that he needs to be thinking bigger. If those are the risks, just taking marginal measures here and there without really reassessing the entire picture is really a wasted opportunity. It's ironic that actually, you know, today we're discussing this budget, and there are headlines elsewhere that the IMF is calling for bold action for countries, and we've had the OECD recently talking about the need for bold action again, and, you know, big leaps forward. And yet what we're seeing everywhere, Hong Kong and, you know, around the rest of the world, is that everybody's being very timorous and, refusing to think about radical changes.
I'm not a Keynesian, though. I don't think governments should try and spend their way out of recessions. They should let the market function properly, not try to invade it. And there's more invasion of the market in the sense of lots of subsidies in the budget. Talks about fintech was mentioned 13 times, as if banks never used computers before. Talk about subsidies for startups, spending about $13 billion through the Hong Kong Science and Technology Parks in Tung Kwan O Industrial Estate and in the Science Park. Projects at the Cyberport and so on, and that's just using taxpayers' money to try to push the economy in a direction that it might go anyway, but shouldn't be forced.
I missed the word competitiveness in this whole thing. Our rotting standard of English, the cartels, the closed shops, the educational crises that we have, the fiefdoms, the lacking healthcare facilities and the lacking communication between the government and all facets of society. That word competitiveness didn't come up, but those 16 vegetable trucks most certainly did.
And what do you think, Enzio, about all these incentives? Particularly, there are lots and lots of paragraphs, as David mentioned, about high-tech industries and startups. I counted that. I think there was $2 billion.
He almost mentioned Bitcoin. He said blockchain technology.
Yes. If I added it up, it ran into several billion sort of Hong Kong dollars. Is he trying to pick the winners and losers here? I mean, can the government do that better than maybe the private sector? Because there are plenty of venture capital firms and hedge funds out there, aren't there?
Something that it was in the policy address, I think, the other day, this idea that the government should co-invest with venture capitalists in startups. Now, this presupposes that there's some shortage of venture capital in Hong Kong or globally, which I'm not aware that there is. But secondly, has nobody learnt anything from the last time the government did this with the Astri Fund, which the Audit Commission had to review and found an appalling track record of investments. The problem is that the good private equity and venture capital firms, they won't be applying for this money from the government. It'll be the poor asset managers who can't attract institutional money who will go to the government and say, could you give us some money to co-invest in our projects? So they'll get an underperforming portfolio of venture capital and at the same time be distorting the venture capital market.
I think he's a guy who uses Band-Aids to enhance his coffee sweeteners, and that's why I would call them acid saccharin, the more that I think about this, because there is clearly no vision. I mean, the fact that we have these massive cost overruns and these white elephants like the bridge, the railway, this cultural hub, just makes me very concerned, because at some point there will be a tax increase here, and it's going to hit yet again the little man. What I also missed in this whole thing was, instead of trying to steer the economy, why not bundle and help the little guy, the particularly poor, and do negative means testing so that the particularly poor get the money, as opposed to yet further handouts to the people who have the money anyway?
Well, actually, they are doing that, Enzio. There's a scheme for topping up low incomes that's rolling out at the moment. So, you know, that's been done. But they continue to waste money on people who don't need it, like the $2 transport scheme, just for being 65. I'll be there in 15 years' time, and I'll be able to travel virtually anywhere for virtually for free in Hong Kong. And that's a waste of taxpayers' money.
Try the concert subsidies.
So as a counterpoint to this, I mean, if we look at, you know, some of these subsidies and incentives that have been provided for businesses, particularly in the technology sector, I mean, some people, I mean, I noticed the founder of Gaifeng, he says that, you know, that the government actually only invests 1% of GDP in startups, but, you know, on average, other countries invest 2 to 3%. Charles, do you think that's right? Do you think it is right for the government to sort of, you know, try and provide incentives for these types of businesses to help them develop in Hong Kong, or has it got it wrong or gone to the wrong areas?
Well, I mean, one of the comments that was made was that Hong Kong is attractive for startups. So, is that because of the government intervention, or is it because Hong Kong is a good place for startups?
It's because he says it is. It's not really.
But if Hong Kong is attractive for businesses, and you know,
with our high rents,
his policy address that, you know, in his budget that it's attractive place for people to come and set up businesses, why do you need to provide incentives to companies?
Quite.
Wouldn't they
sure.
come
yes.
anyway?
Yeah, that's the point.
Yeah, I mean, he has a habit of dressing things up. He called his Sukuk bonds. You remember when he started off as financial secretary, he went off on this Middle East visit trip and announced that we were going to become an Islamic finance hub of Asia. Well, so far, the entire Islamic finance bond market in Hong Kong consists of two government bonds. And he says, building on the success of that, he will seize the opportunity to do another one.
That's a 50% increase.
Yes. He is offering kebabs in Disneyland at a government surplus. So
it's a new green
subsidy.
Bonds now.
And
well.
Iron Man, I have to keep reiterating.
Iron Man, that does it for me, yes.
But what was noticeable was one thing that really wasn't mentioned very much was One Belt, One Road, compared to the...
Yes. Oh, if you got a few belts and roads in there, I think there were six of them.
But no money
Not enough to earn another handshake from Beijing, but you know.
There was the setting up of the, by the HKMA, of the unit to have a look further at how to, I suppose, really monetize One Belt, One Road. I mean, one of the initial things I'd see as a concern there is certainly they're looking at using Hong Kong as a bond-raising platform for the One Belt, One Road countries. But if you have a look at it, if you're going to be funding those countries and with a pure tax hat on here, you're going to have interest income coming out. Typically, with most of those countries, it's quite heavy withholding taxes. Hong Kong has 13 tax treaties with out of the 65 countries, 8 in the works. Singapore started off already with 39. So does that make Singapore more attractive jurisdiction for bond raising? So there's something that clearly needs to be worked on.
Well, also, there's mentioning bonds, there's something in there called silver bonds for people over 65 to get artificially high interest rates from government bonds, more than the government pays for everybody else on their bonds. Well, first of all, the government doesn't need to borrow, so why are they issuing more bonds?
How old is the financial secretary? Because there's a lot of over 65 measures.
He'll qualify very soon.
This was one of the measures, wasn't it, that he announced in terms of, you know, the package of things for sort of individuals. I mean, things like, you know, these I bonds and in particular these silver bonds.
What we actually need is a functioning retail bond market. If the government would stop protecting the bank deposits and protecting the banks, by requiring that the banks provide best execution on retail bond issues, then we could have a proper liquid bond market that would be as big as the stock market and allow people to lend money directly to big companies by buying their bonds.
And will silver bonds help people save for the future?
Well, you wouldn't need the silver bonds because you could go and buy some MTR bonds or some Swire Pacific bonds or any company that you feel that you might trust. I'm not saying I trust them, but, you know, that they could have that investment option. Instead, the bond market is reserved for the banks and the interbank market and the professional asset managers and is not accessible to the individual. And then the government comes up with these rinky-dink silver bonds to try and make up for it.
Now, he focused, obviously, on the elderly. Did he focus enough on the poor? I mean, you know, there are poor people who work but don't pay taxes and therefore they don't get the benefits of all these tax reliefs. Public housing tenants have been hit. So,
and
you know,
can they afford the silver bonds?
And they don't qualify, for some of the...
But the thing about welfare is that it shouldn't be treated like some sort of bonus or dividend scheme when the government makes a profit. You should provide welfare on a means-tested needs base.
Yes.
And a steady amount for people who actually need it and not say, oh, we've had a good year, here's a bit of cash.
$6,000 handout.
And so these one-month top-ups, which have become so regular as to become legitimate expectations of the poor, should be converted into fixed amounts and not messed around with
for
the budget
truly
every
needy,
year.
Though.
Yeah, only for the needy. Review the levels of CSSA, keep it means tested, get rid of the bad son letter so you don't have to get sign offs from your children that they're not supporting you. And then if you only spend money where it's needed, you can afford to do more for the poor.
So when he's discounted sort of rent waivers, I mean, you know, he's provided waivers on rates now instead of the rent waivers for four quarters. Is this just sort of juggling around with the finances?
It juggles and it distorts because it's never a proportionate refund. I mean, it's $1,000 per quarter, so it favours people with smaller units. Similarly, the income tax, the salaries tax rebate is 75% up to 20,000, so it favors people who don't pay much tax anyway, relative to their taxable income. Rather than just saying, you know, let's have a root and branch review, we'll have a flat rate of tax, it will be 13%, we'll raise the allowances to make sure that nobody pays more tax than they did before, because we certainly don't need more revenue. And we'll stop doing these rebates. And if, in fact, we have a surplus in 1 year or in a rolling 5-year period, we'll take an average, then we'll reduce the tax rates. People need some expectation about what the rate will be. So we'll take the 5-year average. And if that was a surplus, we will cut all of the rates proportionately, keeping profits tax and salaries tax in line to prevent arbitrage.
Now, he started off his speech by condemning the violent clashes in Mong Kok, and he says that this has damaged Hong Kong and, in particular, its tourism industry. And then he ended his speech by lamenting the polarisation in society. And he said the reasons for this are complex, can't be pinned on just one culprit. But he said that if they aren't fixed, what lies in store for Hong Kong will be even greater chaos, and our future generations will grow up. Some people have said this was, you know, a sort of a policy speech, wasn't it? But let me ask each of you then. You know, if this is the case, and the budget clearly is about politics just as much as it is about finance, has he provided, because it's within his his power, isn't it, in some ways, to address some of those issues that particularly young people are complaining about?
No, not really.
Which is that you know, they can't get on the housing ladder, they feel left out of the economy. Has this provided any solutions to that?
Those aren't the issues, really. The big issue is democracy. If people could elect a government on a policy platform, then there will be a competition
God
for policies.
God help us if we had democracy as we have it in Legco, David. Jesus
there would be Christ. That's the issue. It's the government is completely dysfunctional. Nothing's getting through Legco because they do at least have the ability to filibuster, but they have no other power. We can't elect a government through a competition for policy platforms. If we could, then the majority of the people would presumably be happy with the person they'd elected, even if it was a socialist platform or a capitalist platform. So, you know, it would be an elected platform. And so that's the root issue. And when the government tries to say, oh, well, if we just give them a bit more money or a few more subsidies or make them do startups, they'll be happy, that's just patronizing in the extreme. It's actually about having freedom and choice.
So, Michael, are these are these riots and are these, you know, these conflicts, are they damaging the Hong Kong economy, do you think?
Well, not really. I mean, I don't think most foreigners are even aware they're happening, to be honest. They don't, you know, get international headlines. It's not something that's going to stop someone coming on holiday
here. I'm
sorry,
they've got massive international headlines.
Well, it depends which country you're in.
I mean, the United States is a rather large country.
Not in China, obviously.
No.
But that's the point.
Albeit it did stop tourists coming down over the
Well, we don't want tourists anyway, so why he's wasting money on a tourism budget, God knows.
But, I mean, that's the kind of aggravation you generally see on, you know, any Saturday night in any town in the UK, quite frankly. It's not really going to be a game changer. But the underlying structural issues that Hong Kong faces, you know, David's touched on them very, very well. And no, there was no vision there in the budget to change it. But equally, to be completely fair again, across Asia Pacific, which is what I look at, everyone's in the same boat. All you get is waffling politicians, waffling finance ministers, all talking about the challenges that we're facing and the need to do X, Y, Z, and none of them can actually, you know, grab the thorns and actually do anything about it.
Perversely, China's the only one that's trying to do a few things on the supply side, but that's, of course, also halting.
Okay, gentlemen. Well, sadly, we've run out of time, but thank you all very much indeed for
your
thoughts on this. That's Enzio von Pfeil, investment strategist at Private Capital, Michael Every, who's head of Financial Markets Research for Asia Pacific at Rabobank, David Webb, independence analyst and author of website.com, and Charles Kinsley, who's tax principal at KPMG.
You're listening to Money Talk.